All right, welcome to Equal Time Soccer. I'm Matt Pavratsky alongside longtime Equal Time star Jenny Clark. Jenny is down in Chicago as an assistant coach at Northwestern now. Jenny, how's it going?
It's going. I thought that I was being cocky about how the weather was so nice down here, and I was like, man, you go a little bit south and it's so much better. And then I found out it's about the same up in Minnesota. So it's been a pretty nice mild winter so far.
For no one is going to be interested in this at all, but for some reason I'm mentioning it in minute one of this show. Jenny is from the Des Moines area. I am from northern Minnesota. I have distinct memories of multiple times, for whatever reason, Jenny and I have small talked about the temperature difference between Des Moines and the Twin Cities, and then the Twin Cities to northern Minnesota. I'm like, God, we are the lamest.
It could be. It could be the one thing that we pretty consistently talk about, real.
I don't talk about weather to anyone else, and somehow anytime you and I talk, we talk about the temperature difference in the upper Midwest.
Clearly, I bring it up because that was the first thing I talked about on the podcast. So
clearly, you have really thrilling topics to bring up to 18-year-olds when you're recruiting them, for sure.
Absolutely. They love it. They love it. They can't get enough.
Jenny has previously been on years ago. I interviewed Jenny in the McDonald's near the U of M. I'm sure that video is like blurry as hell, like crappy Wi-Fi, when you had just returned from playing overseas in the Bundesliga for years. But then since then, you've gotten into coaching. You had time under fellow former Gopher Molly Rouse, who we had on recently. You were at Utah Tech, helping that team transition from D2 to D1. You had time with Aurora here in Minnesota. I'm sure folks who follow Equal Time remember you from that era. But now you're back in the Big Ten, where, of course, you starred for the Gophers. I don't know if I've explicitly said that. You were a star player for the Gophers back in the heyday of those Sweet 16 runs. Mm-hmm. But what's it like being back in the Big Ten? You're with Northwestern, you know, compared to your memories from way back when we're the same age, you know, mid-30s, whatever. What is it like to be at a Big Ten school again after all those years of it being, you know, your entire life?
Yeah, I mean, it's been pretty special to be back in the Big Ten, honestly. I didn't really expect to be doing it in this way, but it was, to have the opportunity to go to Northwestern and work with that program. I don't know how many people have been to that area, but the field is incredible. It's a beautiful campus. And it's been really fun to get back into the rivalries that I had back when I was a Gopher, and kind of find out what rivalries they have here compared to what we had there. And it seems like it's pretty similar. So it's pretty much everybody against everybody, but yeah, it's been really fun to get back into it and to play those big time games and to get pumped up for the Big Ten season. So.
Well, you mentioned the stadium. I've called it out several times. I actually went to what ended up being a heartbreaking game for the Gophers last fall, but at the end of the season, Northwestern and Minnesota were jockeying for possible, you know, back end of the Big Ten tournament seeding. And so I went because I wanted to cover those final matches because the season was on the line. And it was a night game, and it was like pouring rain and just absurd. But the year before, or 2 years before, for folks who had watched the away game, it's on Lake Michigan. It's like gorgeous. And what I always tell people is there was a Gopher fan driving a boat back and forth in the back with the Gopher flag the entire time.
I did not know about that, but I like that was one of the first things that people told me when I was like, yeah, I'm a former Gopher. And they're like, when we played them last year, and they were talking about this boat that was out there, and they're like, we need to get a boat out there this time. And I thought that was pretty funny.
It honestly was an absolute baller move. Like it was, and it was so visible the entire time. But yeah, gorgeous stadium, really cool campus. Like it's sort of the only kind of downside about Elizabeth Lyle Robbie Stadium, the only downside, it is a magical soccer venue, is that it happens to be a little away from campus. And so anytime you go to another Big Ten school where, or any college campus where the stadium is a little more central and there's a little more campus vibe to it. And so, you know, for those who haven't seen all the new athletic facilities at Northwestern, it's sort of this cluster all in one little hub of like, you sort of see the giant field house, you know, you see the, you know, basketball arena, whatever, but you see, you're just standing in one place and you just see sort of the whole vibe. And I remember when I was there, Megan Nemec's family is from the Chicagoland area. Mm. And then, and she had played at Loyola. And so she had played a different Chicagoland area team. And even the people who were from there were like, oh yeah, these are like whatever, you know, they're like, you know about it because it's such a cool facility.
Yeah. Well, it's beautiful. I feel like the first time I went to visit, it was like, and I mean, the indoor stadium also overlooks like Lake Michigan, and it's just, they did it well.
Listen, on anything you put on Lake Michigan, it's just really cool. The morning after the game, I walked Lake Michigan and I'm like, yeah, this is sick. As it turns out, this is really sick.
I get it, Chicago. I get it.
As it turns out, it's cool to be on a Great Lake. You know, go to Duluth. It turns out it's really cool to be on a giant lake. Who knew?
Yeah.
Who knew?
Yeah.
Well, you mentioned some of the rivalries being the same. Obviously, a bunch of the teams being the same means, you know, I'm sure Northwestern also wants to beat Wisconsin, or they have a different, I'm sure they have different rivalries where maybe they care more about Illinois or whoever they care more about. Who were some of the ones that you were surprised? What were just some of the things that surprised you of those, the rivalry stuff of like, oh, there's a longstanding feud with whoever. What were some of the surprise ones?
You know, I think my bigger surprise was that there wasn't more that were like super intense. Like, you know, at Minnesota, you were like, Wisconsin, we're not letting Wisconsin beat us. Right. Me personally, Iowa, I'm not going to let Iowa beat us. Like that kind of stuff. Like it was just, it was really fun ones that were kind of always there. Whereas here it was like, you know, you kind of had always you have intensity in the Big Ten, but there wasn't like just one that was like, oh yeah, that runs deep.
Right.
They did mention there was some with Wisconsin, there was some back in the day, they had something that happened. I don't know, on the field, I think they scored in like the last minute. And then there was just like, we're not never letting them beat us again kind of thing. Right. And so that was pretty fun to like get a relive that a little bit more. But I was also kind of surprised because back when I was playing, obviously we played everybody in the Big Ten and then now we don't really. So it kind of spread out the, like, you know, the Ohio State, we didn't play them this year. So it's just like those kind of ones that you were kind of got more, a little bit more hyped about, at least when we were playing, or I was playing.
Yep.
Just weren't really a part of it as much. So.
Well, because did you play just before the Rutgers Maryland edition?
Yep. Yeah. So I think that they got added. When did it? 2012?
Yeah. So I'm kind of remembering that. So that's interesting. So for those, well, now it's sort of irrelevant, but in the 14 team Big Ten, essentially what happened is you rotate out, like the Gophers, you know, maybe don't go on the Rutgers Maryland trip. That's like every 4 years or whatever it would be. Cause then the second year, maybe those teams come to you, but then also that happens with both Ohio State and Penn State as sort of the far away programs. Now with the new lineup, the only thing I've heard is you definitely don't do, like a team like Minnesota will never do the double trip, will never do Northwest and LA. And I, for all I know, actually you probably have the schedule, they're just not unveiled. I think from what I've heard that the Big Ten like schedule is known, but obviously you can't talk about it, but like those, how much has conference realignment into this new slate, including those West Coast teams, how much has that sort of undercurrented everything you're doing with prep and even like travel and costs and like recruiting? Like now you'll be out there. So do you tell random West Coast kids like, come see us, we'll be in, you know, Washington or whatever? How has it impacted you so far?
Well, I think the unique thing about Northwestern is it does attract people from coast to coast. So that really hasn't changed the recruiting strategy that we kind of have. I mean, it's a super high academic school, which has been really fun to be a part of. And there's just a lot to offer outside of just the sporting side. So I think that that's not really changed too much on how we're aligning that. And I would say in the off season, I mean, it's really hard to say the difference because this is my first year here. But I would, you know, there's always those things in the back of your mind of who you're going to be competing with and at what level you're going to have to be keep competing at consistently. And I mean, in the Big Ten in general, this last year, there was, you know, how many teams made the NCAA tournament and had very, you know, high RPIs. Like it's a competitive conference. And I mean, just adding these extra teams, it's going to continue to rise the level of the conference. But just shows, you know, in these off seasons, we have to be preparing in the same ways that we would otherwise, because it's, you know, it's really no different. Maybe different style of play we'll have to play against, but pretty similar in level of competition.
Yeah, for really, really rough metrics for people, and these numbers are going to be wrong, but they're vaguely right. Like the way I think about it is typically Oregon or Washington have been vaguely within the range of like Minnesota's quality in the last few years, maybe a little higher, a little lower, whatever. And Minnesota last year had an RPI of like 82 or something. So Minnesota was outside of the Big Ten tournament field, but an RPI of 82 means like you're not entirely outside of the fringe of like the NCAA tournament. You know, like you are basically a few games here or there, you know, you are on that doorstep. And that's what you've seen from very vaguely where like programs like Washington and Oregon have been, or maybe sometimes a little higher, whatever. But the LA schools have been, they're pretty legit. Okay. You like UCLA, USC are like top 10, if not top five, if not top one, like quality teams. These are crazy, crazy high level programs. And so, like you say, the style of play will actually be really fun to see, but those games are going to be immediately those climb to being some of the toughest games of the year when you have to do that LA trip. When you saw the announcement, what do you remember about when the announcement came down? Or even not the announcement, but when you actually found out? Because I'm sure maybe you knew the day before or day of or whatever, but when you found out, what do you remember thinking when it's like, UCLA?
Well, I think, I mean, I don't... Well, first of all, I personally just love competing against the best. So I think it's kind of fun to have them coming into the conference and having another challenge to be able to overcome. So for me, you know, it wasn't more of like a whatever. It was more like, oh, interesting. We're just, you know, the Big Ten is coast to coast. And it, I was more like, you know, I played in the Big Ten when it meant something, but then somebody was like, you played when there was 11 teams, not 10. I was like, oh yeah, you're right. That kind of thing. But it was, but like, I think that that was really what my thought process was, is I was like, oh, that's kind of like, that'll be interesting. It'll be different. Like, Northwestern played against UCLA about 2 years ago in the NCAA tournament. And they competed really well against them. I mean, the style of play and how Northwestern plays really lines up really well with them. So I think it was pretty, from my understanding, a pretty competitive game. And so I foresee that being something that we're able to consistently do no matter who we're playing. So
yeah, you mentioned the Northwestern style of play. That actually makes me think one difference with you going to Northwestern is when you joined Utah Tech, you all were starting sort of together. And so there was kind of a you, Molly Rouse, and I believe also former Gopher Lindsay Dare, right? So so it's like an all Minnesota coaching staff in southern rural Utah, by the way. So I'm sure everyone there loved shredding your accents the entire time.
I mean, we just kind of, I don't know. It was, that was probably some of the most fun times, is like coming back together as former Gophers and like just reliving everything that we went through. And then like also just like riffing off each other constantly. It was like probably some of my favorite times as being a coach. And I was like, man, it is fun to be back on the field. And it was just, yeah, I loved it. But I wouldn't say, I'm pretty sure that we had some things that people brought up that we had our accents a little bit here and there. But for the most part, I think we kept that at bay. We just talked about Minnesota all the time. They had to have been so annoyed with us and how much we talked about Minnesota.
They were like, up until now, I'd never even heard of or thought of this state.
Idea where it was. They were like, where is this? I don't even, it's like, it's one of those that you fly over. I don't know.
you were like, you guys are college students.
let's learn our geography. Yeah.
But in that instance, you come in, you know, and you have to learn what Molly wants to institute, blah, blah, blah. But in that instance, you all kind of create it together, or at least you're there as it's getting implemented. With Northwestern, you're coming in with, you know, longstanding D1 program, longstanding Big Ten program, you know, pretty known entity in terms of like quality of team in general. You know, it's a place where like you said, like it's a known soccer entity. Mm-hmm. What was it like having to sort of learn that system as someone who comes in, has to learn it so you can coach it kind of thing?
The people that I work with have been incredible. Michael Moynihan, the head coach, he's a brilliant soccer mind. So it's very lucky for me to have somebody that, you know, not only is a great soccer mind, but also like willing to mentor and help me with understanding like the style of play that we're wanting.
Right.
Rich Manning, who's also been in the game forever. And he, you know, is, again, knows a ton about soccer, knows how to break it down and how this is how we want to play, different ways of being able to connect with players. I think that he's been incredible. And then Morgan also was just awesome with like, if I didn't understand something, I can pull her aside and we can kind of talk it out together. And so I would say the staff made it really easy for me to kind of come in and be able to have the understanding of the way that they were playing. But at the same time, I would say principles wise, and how you play soccer and stuff, like sometimes some things like differ in exactly what we want to do, but the principles wise, I would say that we were pretty aligned in how we saw the game. So it was pretty easy for me to kind of bring my influence in, right from the get go. And it was nice. I also, you know, have these brilliant soccer minds that also trust the things that I'm saying and trusting that I, you know, and know what I'm talking about when I'm talking to the players. So, it was a really good transition for me, and especially with the people that I'm working with and the players that I'm working with. They're incredible humans and then wildly smart people that really do want to learn and get better. And so it's been really fun to work with them.
Well, and you mentioned sort of that aspect of how do we see the game? So like which things jumped out to it first, you know, I always find that really interesting of sort of what are things you look for versus what other coaches look for and all of that stuff. Another piece of coaching that I actually hear people talk about a lot, like especially like when you were transitioning to coaching or anytime someone is transitioning into coaching, I constantly hear other coaches say like, yeah, she's doing great. You know, she's really working on developing her coaching voice. Like the phrase coaching voice is so commonly said in that setting. And I've never heard anyone write it down. I've never heard anyone say it outside of that, but it's the most prevalent thing of, you know, someone figuring out it's a loaded phrase. It's a loaded phrase. It's not like literally, well, I guess it could literally mean how you're talking on the field, like mm-hmm. projecting across the field, mm-hmm. but it's your presence. It's your personality. It's mm-hmm. like how you come across, how you lead a session. Like there's like seven aspects to it, but talk about that. Like when you started coaching and you're working with Molly or you're working at Northwestern, When people say like developing your coaching voice, what do you remember about like those early conversations or even how you perceived like that phrase?
That's a good question. I don't know if that's like something that I've kind of overall thought. I think that maybe it's been said here or there. I would say I was a center back, so I always kind of had that voice, and I always kind of had that directional instinct of, you know, telling people what to do, how to do it, and that kind of thing. And leadership wise, I was with some incredible leaders throughout, so I kind of learned how to connect with players if they weren't responding with how I was telling them something, pulling them aside, talking to them, letting them know this is what I'm seeing and being able to talk it out. And especially towards the end of my career, I was generally one of the older ones on the team, so was able to kind of do that for them. So I would say the transition into my confidence on the field, being a coach and being able to project what I'm saying and also admit when I don't really know like what the answer is, I haven't found that to be that big of a transition. And I would maybe, you know, maybe others would have a different opinion on that. But I would say that transition for me wasn't as big on like finding the coaching voice. I think I think because of how much I played and where I played, it made it pretty easy to transition into the coaching side. That being said, there's still a ton that I'm learning about coaching and there's still a ton that I'm learning about management of players and everything like that. So I think that that's been, that's maybe part of the coaching voice that I'm like still developing. So.
Yeah. I remember even when you came back and you were back in Minnesota after playing in, you know, the Bundesliga for all those years, I remember thinking how funny it was that like a dynamic you had to play with was that you quote unquote didn't have enough coaching experience because instead you'd been playing professionally. It's like the idea of it was so funny that you were catching up to other same aged coaches. And it was because you, like, no one said wrongly, but it's like you didn't choose to coach. Instead, you were playing pro. And so the idea of, I'm behind because I wanted to keep playing pro and I was able to play pro. What the hell?
No, definitely a struggle that has come up for that. And I mean, to an extent, I can understand it. I mean, it's hard to say on the resume, but I think that sometimes that can be a little bit of a part of the struggle of it. So.
Well, and even your years over in the Bundesliga, I think it's easy for people now to see all the attention national teams get, all the attention some of the European leagues get. Even now, honestly, I never hear any discourse that, like, Bundesliga teams do super well in Champions League. Like, they are very good. Like, they are high quality. But I still don't hear about, like, the Bundesliga is not in the discourse. I mean, no one is talking about the Bundesliga on, like, the random women's soccer Twitter accounts or whatever's, just by random whatever. The only overseas league that gets any shine is England, so I guess maybe it's similar to the men's side. But like, for you when you were playing there, how would you convey to people now what it was like for you as a pro athlete back then? Like, how would you compare, like, fan support or, like, broadcast or coverage, like, what did it feel like to you back then? Because it wasn't that long ago, but I think in women's soccer terms, it is a different era from what happens now.
Well, it's pretty interesting. I mean, and you say that you never hear anything about the Frauen Bundesliga or the men's Bundesliga. A lot of times you see it sometimes on TV and stuff. But I will say brother-in-law was at the gym the other day and they had a Frauen Bundesliga game on at the gym. So I thought that was pretty cool. Baby. And we're just, you know, we're building here, but also, you know, it's a different language. A lot of the fans speak a different language. So a lot of the blogging, a lot of the other stuff was happening.
Good point.
Probably in a different language. So it kind of was hard to follow along with. But that being said, it has changed significantly. Like I said, back when I was playing, it would not have been on TV at the gym. They've invested just a ton of money into it. They've started highlighting things a lot more. I see things all the time on Instagram. I see things people are posting. I have friends that are getting sponsored by different, different products that they never were before. So it's very similar to here that you're getting more attraction on it. I think it's just been incredible since I've been done playing. It feels like how long has it been? Like six, seven years. I'm not really sure. Might be more, that I've been done playing. And I think that the level of soccer has gone up significantly in the in the whole world, which has been awesome. And I think that a lot of that is contributed to the amount of investment that people have put into the sport money-wise. And I think that that's been a lot different. When I was playing, I think the biggest struggle was people wanted to come play. Like it was like, they didn't know. I played for SC Freiburg for most of my career. And I was down there and I remember I was out, I met somebody and they were like, I was like, oh yeah, I play for the Frauen Bundesliga team. And they're like, oh, there's a women's team. Like they just had no idea. And they're like, I would totally go to those games. I just didn't know that there was a women's team. And so it's just like the struggle of like having, you know, you have to have advertisement. You have to let people know that it's happening. And, you know, when they know, a lot of times they come. So I think that was part of the struggle of it. We got decent fans, a couple hundred a game, but I wouldn't say that it's as much as it is now, and definitely not as much consistently. I think the most I played in front of was like 9,000. My first season there, we were playing against Potsdam.
Was it a cup game or something?
If they won that game, then they won the league. And the first team I played on was Lok Leipzig. So it was in Leipzig and it was not a very good team. They got relegated. They got promoted that last year and then relegated the next year. We got destroyed 9-0. And we were playing against it. It was just the wildest crowd that I'd ever heard until I went to Aurora. And Aurora is now the wildest crowd that I've ever
Oh yeah.
Been in front of. So I think that that was, that's been pretty cool to see for women too.
I still tell people all the time, like the Aurora crowds, I tell people all the time, even the players on Aurora who have played pro, like that doesn't mean they've played in front of crowds like that.
And no,
because when I was very early on, when games were like vaguely selling out, but not like max selling out, and there was a few games that had brutal heat that like didn't have a ton of attendance, and people were like, yeah, well, no, maybe Jenny did. And I'm like, guys, like maybe. And I'd remember once. That game. Or like, you know, I just told them, I was like, listen, yeah. The example I always give people is the Gopher soccer attendance is actually really strong. They get mm-hmm. They average somewhere between like 900 and 1200 a game. Mm-hmm. And that's usually about top 25 in the country for D1 women's college soccer.
Mm-hmm.
And a full ELR stand, like when there's like 2000 people there for Rock the Robbie against Wisconsin, is like pretty damn fun. Like it mm-hmm. is a pretty good environment, mm-hmm. but that's 2000. And so then yeah. compare it to like, okay, three times that size, five times
yeah.
that size.
Yeah.
Or if you're at Allianz and it's completely full and there's a goal, like the level of intensity just ratchets all the way up.
Just so, way up, yeah.
So having any bigger crowds is so huge because it shows like, oh, it was so fun to have five. What if we had 10? What if we had 20? And mm-hmm. I do think like your point about people just don't know. And mm-hmm. part of it that I try and call out, and I could maybe call it out more, is like it means a lot for teams and programs to invest in promoting and marketing themselves. It obviously people know I care about other people covering the teams too, but mm-hmm. you know, we'll cover, Mark and I will go cover everything, but it matters when teams invest on their own side into mm-hmm. marketing, media relations, they're communicating it out, they're doing a good job on social. That matters. Like we try to shout out when teams having a good broadcast matter. It matters mm-hmm. so much. Can mm-hmm. I find the game? Can I watch the game? Will it not be living hell to watch this game once yeah. it's on there? So mm-hmm. it matters, and clubs investing in it matters. And we as fans and people who cover this stuff, like we have to shout it out, support it, and just keep pushing for it, because mm-hmm. even spending money to add one staff member only during the season to do like marketing and promotion, that's huge. It matters. It matters mm-hmm. because
totally
random people are busy. They're drowning in stupid internet
make
stuff.
It easy. Like, yeah.
You don't know. So you just have mm-hmm. to tell them and whatever. Yeah. That's a lot.
I think that was what the coolest part about Aurora was. I think one day I was driving home, and it was just, I don't know, it was a random day. I think it was before season started, and I was listening to NPR, and there was just like, on the newscast, yeah. they just mentioned something about Aurora. And I was just like, that's so like, it's yeah. just cool. Like making it easy for people to be aware of it.
Yeah,
and I was totally. Just like, that's all you need. Just, and that's exactly what I felt when I was there. I was like, man, we just put a poster up, like let people yeah. know that there's something there.
Right.
So that you can, you like, they're like, oh, I had no idea. That's crazy.
You're like, go staple some stuff to light poles, man. What
you yeah. Back in the, you know, back in brick and mortar, we're just, you know, brick by brick.
Do you still keep in touch with anyone you played with back then? Like, is there anyone we'd be surprised that you like overlapped with, or do you still check in with people? Like, I think the
with
story.
With Gophers?
Or no, with like with the Bundesliga teammates you had and that stuff.
Okay.
I always tell people, I haven't had her on forever, but the example I always give people is Kelsey Hood, who is another one of your teammates who went to Norway to play, played professionally in Norway for however many years, like 4, 5, 6, I think even longer, because she then like got back into whatever, played forever, mm-hmm. met a Norwegian dude, married him. She literally lives there, and like she is Norwegian now. Like she's
a dream.
A Norwegian yeah. yoga instructor. And like the other day, Brian Karstad, longtime Minnesota soccer writer who used to write about the Gophers probably when you were playing, he tweeted, does anyone know someone who knows Norwegian? I need to translate something. And I'm like, former Gopher Kelsey Hood, who you covered, is definitely fluent Norwegian.
Just the person, actually. amazing.
But do you have any random connections with like the folks you met in Germany or teammates that like, were you one of the few Americans? I mean, I think people lose track of that too.
Yeah, no, I mean, I on my team, I ended up playing with Fiona O'Sullivan, who is out in California now. She was on the Irish national team for a while, and she went to USF. Choma Igwe, who played at Santa Clara, and she actually married a German guy. She lives over there still. Catherine Reynolds, she played in, I don't know if she changed her last name, but she was at Portland Thorns for a long time. And, after she left, so those were the Americans I mostly played with, for the big part of my time. Mm-hmm. I played with like Sophie, Yuki Nagasato, who's down at Houston Dash. She was here for a while and we were trying to get together, but wasn't able to actually get together.
Yuki is like a visible, like it, when I think of the NWSL or whatever, like the Red Stars or whatever, she's like one of the handful that you think of like Olympics, World Cup, NWSL. Yeah. Like she's of this era.
she was big time. I played with her at Frankfurt and we roomed together. And so now she speaks really good English, but like she didn't speak much English and obviously I didn't speak Japanese. And so we'd speak together in German. And our relationship was pretty funny, actually. I think that when people would listen to us talk, they were just like, all right, didn't make sense.
Your crappy German.
We were having two different conversations probably most of the time, but it was fantastic. And she's so funny. And I'm excited to watch her play down in Houston.
Oh, that's so great.
I think like there's just so many people that you know I kind of ran past and or like ended up playing with that you kind of keep in touch with, and if you saw each other, you would, but like it's not you don't keep up daily.
As it turns out, I think you might be busy. Who knows? I think from what I've heard,
there's stuff going on. You know, I do. It's full time job keeping up with people. So
it is. Yeah, it is. Yeah. You're like I'm going to showcases, man. I'm busy. By the way, shout out our sponsors. I got Modest Brewing Super Deluxe right here. Shout out to Pence Homes for supporting us. This is an open call to you, Jenny, to anyone else. I want to and will produce a House Hunters-like show with the Pence Homes agent helping people search for a house. I will produce it. Whoever takes me up on it gets to star in their own version of House Hunters that I will produce. If anyone needs to look for a house in Minnesota, I might even be willing to do it in another state. So someone get nuts and take me up on this. Because I just want to do it.
I'm going to put it out there.
Start giving out
little peanuts of it to everybody. See if anybody takes you up.
Put it out there. So you come back from the Bundesliga. We mentioned your first sort of, major public coaching, you know, role is with Molly Rouse at Utah Tech. I had her on the show last week. I asked her, you know, what kind of stuff should I throw at Jenny? And the one thing she brought up is how much the word building became a big part.
build. And I actually do it now too. I talked to her this morning, actually. I don't even know if we said anything. I think we were just joking the whole time. But I like started bringing that to Northwestern. I go, build. And I think I started saying it. I didn't even think I was saying it. And then somebody was like, oh, and then I said something about layers and they're like, I'm surprised you didn't say build there, Jen. And I was like, yeah, that's Smalley thing. So you got that.
I'm assuming what it's about. You were taking a team from D2 to D1. You probably had to remind players like, we might lose games. We might not be winning right away, but like you're literally building a program from scratch. I'm sort of assuming this is what it was based on, but was it even more literal than this? Were the hand gestures?
I think just like one day I was just like, we build. And then I think Molly was like, we build. And I was like, and we build and we build and we build. Then I think that we didn't stop saying it. I think it was just literally that. And we just knew, I mean, at the core of it, we just knew that we had to continue building a program.
Right.
And I think sometimes when you just keep saying it over and over, it just like continues to happen, annoy the kids with it. They love it. you know, they'll laugh with you at some point. That's what I've decided. You say it enough, somebody will laugh. Right. So that's my coaching philosophy, at least. Well,
it started off being not funny. Then it becomes funny because it isn't funny. And then you're just like,
repetition. Just get it in their head. They can't get it out. It's good. It's good.
It's hard dad joke vibes from a fairly young woman.
Me and Maul, we went on, and it sounds like she's brought it to Ole Miss, and I've been saying it quite a bit at Northwestern too. So,
it's going to be spreading across the nation,
its wings.
Well, and speaking of building, and like all jokes aside, I do find it really interesting to think about how hard it is to either turn a program around, a progressive program or whatever in college soccer. And people probably think like it's the portal era. You can just add talent. Like it can be fast. Look what happened at Michigan State. And they'll like look at some random single example. But my perspective is it seems like it is a marathon to try and build a program. It is a marathon to try and go from being a lower third to mid-table team. And then from mid-table to top table, then to stay at the top table. Like to me, the teams like Mark and I cover for Equal Time, the teams I've covered forever, it just feels like it's really, really hard and it can take forever. But you as a coach, how do you think about that progression of like, how do we balance the difficulty of something needing to be sustainable versus just a flash in the pan versus we need players to feel the pressure of needing to work, but we need to reward them enough that they're motivated. Like the progressing a program and building a program, to me, I've never been firmer in believing like it just seems really, really damn hard. But for you as a coach, what's it felt like now being through a few different phases of like starting something from scratch, like, you know, Utah Tech kind of, or Aurora or whatever, but then also coming into an incredibly established, pretty successful, like Big Ten team like Northwestern. And that's not building, but you still are trying to progress. You know, Northwestern would love to go from where they in Minnesota were last year, stressing about making the Big Ten tournament. Mm-hmm. They'd love to be like, we're always hosting a tournament game and then whatever. Mm-hmm. How do you think about stuff like that?
Yeah, I think, I would say this is credit to Molly. I don't know if it's something that I recognized until I worked with her and saw the importance of it and how effective it is, but just consistency and how you're coaching, how you're presenting information, and being willing that when things are still not going well to like believe in what your path is and be consistent with that path. Right. And I think that, you know, while I was at Utah Tech, I think we were in that building stage and they did really well after I had left as well, which I think that we had worked really hard to create the framework for it and then continuing into that. But I do think that being consistent with everything that you do and pretty transparent with people on how you're doing it, I think has been the biggest thing, because I think that helps with the management of players. It helps with the management of the program. Everybody knows what to expect. There's not blindsided by anything.
Right.
And being able to, you know, just really have what your values are and sticking to what those values are as you continue to build through everything.
Right.
And I would say that was, I mean, again, credit to Molly. I think that she does an incredible job of that. I learned a ton from her while I was out there doing that,
right,
out at Utah, doing that with her. And I think that that's something that I brought, you know, and the same thing with Nicole working with her at Aurora. It was just us. We had this is what we're wanting to do, and staying super consistent in what we're wanting to do and being pretty protective of how that consistency played out. And, I think that in both ways, they've been really effective. And I think in the same way, like, and that's kind of how I've brought myself into, you know, both of those, I was coming in as a coach with everybody else. This, right. I'm coming in as a coach, like, you know, by myself, like entering a program. But I think that the same principles applied with me wanting to stay consistent of who I am as a coach, what kind of things I'm coaching. I'm still going to learn. I'm still going to evolve. But like, how can I make sure that I'm showing up in a consistent way? People know what to expect when I'm there, and how I'm presenting information to them. And hopefully that continues to help with the program so that we are more consistently in the Big Ten tournament, making the NCAA tournaments, going a couple years ago, going to the Sweet 16, consistently making Sweet 16 and beyond. So,
right. I realized I need to say this before I forget that I mentioned the Bundesliga, and I have to shout out fellow former All-American Gopher player Rashida Beal, who went over to play in the Frauen Bundesliga 2 right before shutdown.
Oh,
and
no.
then was, I'm saying this phrase, stuck in Germany during shutdown when no one knew if leagues were going to restart. But I just realized, I'm like, wait, I got Rashida's jersey right here. We got to drop this Bundesliga nugget in there. We got to drop it in there. You mentioned the transparency piece of like being consistent, being clear, being transparent. And that I think is really, it's really interesting. And it's a big dynamic because I very regularly hear from either like players or whatever about a lot of their stress of all the million things that players have stress about. A lot of their stress sometimes comes from, and this is not true of every player, but do I know mm-hmm. what my role is? Do mm-hmm. I know my place in the team? Do I know what I need to do to get from my current place to where I think my place should be? Mm-hmm. And do I know that not just globally, but do I know it like in the minute? Because mm-hmm. I think the stress when I talk to players or like players' families or whatever, to me, that seems like the single biggest stressor that players mm-hmm. carry with them is like, I don't know if I'm in the rotation. I feel like they're not telling me what my role is. I feel like they're not telling me how I can get whatever. Like whether it's whatever percentage from 0 to 100, it's true. And I think mm-hmm. it's always at least somewhat true. Mm-hmm. That stress seems so prevalent. And so mm-hmm. when you talk about transparency, like how specific do you feel like you have to get in order for the player to like process that information? And I'm sure it's different for every mm-hmm. player, but how much is that a part of your role of like, they have to feel at least in the loop because otherwise they will, you know, not be locked in or they'll leave mm-hmm. or whatever. Talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question. Cause I think as a former player, it makes it pretty easy to get into what those shoes are. And that's kind of how I've gone about being a coach. You know, we talked about the coaching voice. A lot of my coaching voice also reverts back to me as a player and what I needed as a player to right. be my best. And then also recognizing, oh, that's why the coach was doing that. Like that kind of, right. it's a very interesting dynamic of being a coach after being a player right. and reflect on your playing days after having coached, you're like, oh, that's a little harder than I thought it was actually. and they are just a lot of times it's uncomfortable conversations and it's being really organized on what your expectations are and are they meeting expectations or not.
Right.
And it is, I would say, I think sometimes you think that you're being clear and you're not being as clear as you think you are. And I'm right. not like, I find myself doing that a lot of being like, oh, I thought that that's what was portrayed, but clearly that wasn't. So right. I think that that's a constant battle as a coach is like continuously self-evaluating, reflecting and making sure that, you know, how you're wanting to say something, the way you're wanting to say something is how it's being received
yeah.
and consistent check-ins and making sure that those are part of it as well. So I think that that's, I totally understand what the word players are coming from on that. And yeah. then also on the flip side of like how difficult it is, because sometimes you really do think that you're being clear.
Yeah.
And it may not be heard in the same way that it's said. So well, I think that's tough.
And you have this pressure as a coach where you do want to be really honest, but you also very much have to take into account sort of every second of those interactions. Okay, this player can be coached this way. And mm-hmm. another player might be able to be pushed really hard. This one actually has to be really uplifted. Like I joke all the time because I was such a trash player anyway, it doesn't matter. But I didn't grow up playing for coaches who had really played or coached. And so I never really learned how to be coached. And so mm-hmm. I don't think I was easy to be coached. Not in like any arrogant way, but like I didn't know how to take feedback and mm-hmm. I didn't know how to take anything other than like practical, proactive, like guidance
mm-hmm.
because I legitimately like I didn't know how to process it. Like as a teenager, like as a late teen, like there's no way. I didn't even know how to do any mm-hmm. of that. Mm-hmm. And so I constantly think when I see like how young some of these college players are, mm-hmm. they all have to be coached probably a little different. So then the pressure on you is, well, I do need to be honest, but I also have to like speak the way this player can be coached. And so do you find yourself, like what types of players do you find you most easily can just be like, oh, they naturally process the way I process? You know, like what are the players that you don't have to put as much like heavy lift into that you just gravitate towards? Oh, well, they want to be pushed and I know how to push and blah, 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 versus if someone just needs to be built up, is that even more simple? Because you're like, well, I know how to build someone up. Like everyone can like build someone up. Do you find yourself more easily communicating with certain types of players versus others?
Yeah, I think that that's something that I'm continuously evaluating, because I do think that even the ones that you're like, oh, I can push them. Like we all have our days and we all have our moments of like the mental game isn't there as much as I thought that the mental game was there. So that's like something I've always kind of had. And what I've kind of leaned back on is really knowing who the individual is and like being able to have like an actual out of soccer conversation of seeing how that they are. Can I joke with them in a certain way? Can I not joke with them in a certain way? Can I bring this up to them so that it doesn't feel like an attack? Or maybe at some point they need to understand what adversity looks like and how that feels, and can I rise up to it? And I think that that's still a challenge that I'm working through as an assistant coach. I think it's a little bit different of a dynamic than a head coach. And the assistant coach kind of has the fun part of like really being able to figure out how do they respond to stuff? And like, maybe if you hear it, something over here, I'm keeping an eye on, oh, they didn't receive that exactly what I don't think that they received that how it was actually given. Like I can pull them aside and kind of talk to them and have those relationship conversations a little bit more. So I think that that's just, you know, part of being a coach, and actually probably my favorite part of being a coach has been what the relationships are. And, you know, one of my biggest values is helping support strong, confident women that are going to go out into the world and, you know, be great leaders. And so I think part of that is being able to challenge them a little bit so that they're pushed outside of their comfort zone, but then also feel like they're in a safe space so that they can have that. So hopefully once they leave there, that they're going to continue growing and being badass women. Mm-hmm. So
I love that you mentioned that part of it, because I say it on shows too, but I could maybe even say it more, like how impressive these players are is just like, mm-hmm. is wild to me. I mean, I regularly will interview like a freshman and they're super nervous like before. And they're like, oh, what should I do? Blah, blah, blah. But then in the interview, they're just giving this like great thing, or they'll do a whole show and they'll break down like tactics and they'll talk about whatever. And, you know, they have some crazy GPA or like jobs on the side, or they've done all this cool work. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. it's just really, I mean, it's just a lot of really impressive people. And like, mm-hmm. and like you said, these like really, these super badass women. I mean, it's the reason I started Equal Time, obviously, mm-hmm. but it's, mm-hmm. it still just continues to be such a fun thing where I'm like, I feel like I'm kind of intimidated by her. Like, you know, like you talk to someone who's like 19 and I'm like, I'm not sure.
But it's awesome.
Like, you're like, I'm like, oh my God, who the hell is this? Like, this is nuts.
Yeah. No, but I think it's so fun to be around. And I think that that's my favorite. That is actually my favorite part of coaching is being around just like these women that are, you know, have goals and want to achieve them and are going to work their asses off to get there. And it's just like, okay, you're going to go out into that world and you're going to kick ass. And I'm excited about it.
Yeah. It's just, it's super rad. And I think, you know, I particularly appreciate it just because getting to cover multiple levels of college soccer and cover women who go on and play pro, and you just see players from different backgrounds who have different level of opportunity. I mean, like, honestly, I will be honest, like covering the NSIC, like Minnesota's D2 programs, is probably where I have that feeling the most. 'Cause I'm like, these kids are getting no hype. They didn't get to go shiny D1. They didn't do whatever. But like, St. Cloud had a Cinderella season last year where they win the conference for the first time. They go to the national tournament for the first time. They get to host the NSIC conference tournament. You know, they go to the national tournament.
Mm-hmm.
And you're just like, these kids got picked like ninth in the conference. Like, they're out here shredding. Like,
that's awesome.
And they play beautiful soccer, like crazy nice soccer. Like, and you and I both know very successful college soccer programs can play not pretty soccer. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Very, very successful D1 mm-hmm. women's college soccer teams
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
do not always play like glamorous, pretty, beautiful soccer. Mm-hmm. St. Cloud, like a random team, you go to a random game and St. Cloud is just like passing and moving and whatever, and I'm like, what the hell is this? This is so mm-hmm. This is sick.
Yeah, that's awesome. I love to hear that. That's great.
I didn't tweet about the game, but I filmed some highlights and I went up to Greta after, and I was like, went up to Greta and Jade, the coaches, and I was like, you guys play really fucking good soccer.
That's
I like,
awesome.
I was like, oh my god, what are you guys doing up here?
Mm-hmm. Hey, just working on some possession, building it forward. We love it.
Just some women absolutely crushing it, coaching at St. Cloud State. Okay.
Love it. Love it. Yeah.
I am curious too. You mentioned like different, how do you talk to different players, all that stuff. When you're recruiting and you're watching the game, what are some of the things that jump out quickest to you? Because my brain is a little bit too simple. I haven't done like coach education. And so I still really gravitate, you know, I know the things that are going to jump out at me, and they're really basic. Like, I'll notice, you know, physical tools, confidence on the ball, you know, work rate. Like, I notice incredibly basic pieces of someone's game, and I have to watch quite a while before I pick up like more nuanced stuff. For you, what are some of the things you find yourself either gravitating towards in a player's game, or the things that jump out to you quickest?
Mm-hmm. I think that there's a variety. I mean, you kind of hit the ones like, honestly, maybe there are, but like, I would say most college coaches, those are things that we're looking for what are the physical attributes that they're able to bring in? How confident are they on the ball? I think about what their positioning looks like. Are they looking off the ball when they don't have the ball so that they can see different spaces? What spaces are they going to try to get into? And just, you know, soccer IQ wise, like once they get the ball, are they looking to the right spaces to be able to build the ball forward? Are they looking to build it forward? That kind of stuff. So I think those things, obviously come to mind probably like right away. And I wouldn't say that I'm any different in that, you know, I can watch a game and know right away. Like it takes me a bit to watch games and be able to like recognize, okay, yeah, this is the kid. And sometimes you do go to a field and you're like, whoa, that's pretty impressive human right there. That was great. Right. You know, but like, I think that there's other times that you kind of, I'm still building that ability. Right. Right. On my side, but I would say those are the main parts that I've when I'm watching, those are what I'm looking for.
I even all the evaluation stuff, it blows my mind. Like I could enjoy an entire day just standing near a coach and them just saying all their thoughts out loud. Like I can't imagine how you have to process those events. Cause I mean, I have to think that every single person at the tournament or the event or the training, everyone agrees on like who the most obvious top 20% are. Like that's not the thing. Mm-hmm. You know, the kid who's going to be a star midfielder from day one and play 90 minutes, like no, it's not like people are missing that person necessarily. Mm-hmm. I'm so curious about like the middle 60% mm-hmm. of like where you find the hidden gem, where you see someone that no one else wanted, you know, like another jersey call out. So Annie Williams. Annie Williams, who was a stud for South Dakota State, and now is playing overseas for Parma in Italy, who's coincidentally owned by an Iowa man. So shouts out to Iowa.
Interesting.
I had her on and like we talked about her recruiting process, and she was not drowning in D1 offers. Like she was 2 seconds away from being like an NSIC star. You know, she was mm-hmm. just going to go D2. She goes and immediately is like an absolute baller in the Summit League. They win multiple conference championships. She's like not only all conference but all region, and she's just like a super athletic badass 5'8" outside back for South Dakota State. And it's like, but wait, how did they all miss her though? Like, I feel like when I watch her, I'm like, well, she's a really athletic, like tall right back who can get downfield and rip. So, and I get that I got to see her when she was like a senior. So for all I know, she was like raw as a freshman or something, but I just like how to find, how to not miss wrong where you overrate and how to not miss wrong where you underrate. I can't imagine the stress you carry into those events like that.
I think, I mean, I would say that that's something that all college coaches, like, you have that risk, like, every time. Like, I think you have the kid that you're not going to miss, but then you're also looking at who's the kid with the potential and who's the kid that you're going to bring in and, you know, doesn't. You know, I think you're always going to have a couple of those potentially. Like I and I don't think that everybody gets it 100% 100% of the time, because it is hard. Like, it's hard to know who's what, when you're watching and like what that middle percentage is. I would say, like, for me, then you're kind of judging on like how much grit do they have? Like, and that's more of like, once you get to know them, conversations you have, like, conversations with coaches on, you know, what do they do off the field? Like, how are they in training? That kind of stuff. So that you can start to build that character around them to see what's coming into your program.
Yeah. And I do. And it's probably a big part of why some teams are so active in the portal, because you have a slightly higher confidence factor of seeing like, okay, well, when Katie Crone was 17, she's from some other random state and I wouldn't have known her. And why would I have heard of her and blah, blah, blah. Well, Katie Crone played at Buffalo and scored, you know, big, like tons of goals and was playing D1 and looked really good. And so Aaron Chastain can be like, well, yeah, we want Katie Crone. She, we saw her do it against D1 talent and she ripped, you know?
Yeah.
So it's funny. It's just the, but I just think that, yeah, it's just funny to think about. I'm sure the portal gives that confidence factor, but you're also going up against everyone else in the whole country who also saw it. So it's not like it's some gimme.
Yeah, this was my first year with the transfer portal and kind of seeing the workings of it. So that was pretty interesting for me.
Yeah, of you having to be like, okay, well, yeah, this kid is going to come visit us, and they're also going to go check out Michigan State. They're going to check out Loyola, or they're going to check out Stanford, or like
could be all sorts of stuff. Yeah,
hey, this kid wants to be a journalist, so they're checking out us in Mizzou. They're like checking out all the J schools.
Yeah, like, I mean, it's a really interesting dynamic, and I think that that's another thing about Northwestern is like it's so high academic that you do end up acquiring a pretty specific time, but like also you get people, you know, I mean, it's just a very interesting interesting demographic that you're bringing in, and you're pretty specific about who that is as well. So
well, in the most positive way, I will say you have a bunch of nerds on that team for sure. And and honestly, the funny thing is I find that to be really true for a bunch of women's college soccer teams. Like the GPA graphics, the time of the year when the GPA graphics all come out is like so mind-bogglingly absurd. Like as a team, they average like 3.98 or 3.81. And you're like, wait, what are you talking about? Like,
I would say that as well. I think, I mean, like we, I wouldn't say a bunch of nerds, but very intelligent and very intelligent humans on our team. But I would
also
say. That's
a positive word. That's a positive word.
But I would also say like, in general, I feel like soccer does tend to have pretty high academically achieving teams. So
Well, and to be honest with you, I don't know this for a fact, but I'm kind of assuming probably even just women's sports versus men's sports. I'm assuming the GPA split is actually like women natural. I bet women's teams, I would assume they naturally have higher amounts. That's like, I'm making like a giant assumption. I will just tell you being a man and knowing women, I'm guessing, a wild guess.
I have no idea. That would be, you know what? I'm going to do my research.
You don't have to be on the record. You don't have to risk anything, Jenny. I'm the only one who has to risk anything. Don't worry. Well, Jenny Clark, assistant coach down at Northwestern in Chicago. I'm sure it's 10 degrees warmer there than it is in the Twin Cities, as Jenny and I always discuss. former Gopher star, former coach at Utah Tech with Aurora, just an absolute baller, an absolute badass. Now officially, if Minnesotans have a second Big Ten team, it has to be Northwestern. thanks so much for joining us, Jenny.
Thank you, Matt. Have a good one.